This week, I'm joined by Esme Partridge, who is a researcher, writer, and interfaith coordinator specializing in Islamic studies, theology, mysticism, and spirituality in the digital age. In this episode, we discuss spirituality in the digital age, mysticism, and faith in the modern world. I'd like to say a big thank you to all my paid patrons and subscribers for making all of this work possible. And if you would like to support Omitics and get access to some exclusive content, please find links in the description below. Otherwise, please enjoy. So, Esme Partridge, thanks very much for joining us on Omitics Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So we are going to be discussing, I'm trying to think, there's a lot of topics to cover. Astrology, the Enlightenment, mysticism, Islamic mysticism, postmodernism in relation to mysticism, postmodernism in relation to everything, probably the secular world, etc., etc. But before we do so, please tell us a little bit about yourself, and you know, what it is you do.
Sure. So I'm Esme. I have recently graduated from SOAS. I was studying religion with a particular focus on Islamic studies, but I'm also interested in the dynamics of tradition in the modern world, and particularly how secularism and Enlightenment thought have impacted how people, particularly young people, engage with spirituality. So I wrote my dissertation on witch talk, which is the very intriguing phenomenon of witchcraft on TikTok and other forms of digital spirituality, analyzing those as essentially reflections of secularism. And I currently also work as an interfaith coordinator for a social consultancy, and I'm just really interested in how religion intersects with modernity.
Okay. I mean, I could already jump into the witch talk thing, but I know we have a question about that later. But I do want to, I'll ask it then. All right. Before we jump in with these questions, which we've sort of rigorously gone through, to, you know, pick the best ones. I have to ask you the Hermetics question. So you can place three thinkers living or dead into a room and, listen in on the conversation. Who do you pick?
So I would choose the 9th century Muslim polymath Al-Farabi. And then I would also choose the conservative philosopher Roger Scruton. And then I'd also throw in Foucault, just for the contrast. I think that would pose a very interesting debate. So I may as well outline Al-Farabi's worldview for those who aren't already familiar with it. So Al-Farabi was a Muslim political philosopher. And in his political philosophy, which was very, very inspired by Plato, he essentially develops a hierarchy of intellect. And his ideal society, his virtuous city, is effectively a city which is oriented towards the Platonic truths. And every aspect of that society is designed to orient individuals upwards towards those truths. And so, like Plato, Al-Farabi thinks it's very important to have a philosopher king. And since he's Muslim and he integrates a sort of perhaps not theocracy, but there is certainly a strong theocratic element to Al-Farabi's version of Platonic political philosophy. He also says that imams have a similar function to the philosopher king of transmitting the form of the good effectively to the common populace. So like Plato, he believes that there should be a philosopher king, and quite similar to in Plato's Republic, Book 6, I believe, in the analogy of the ship. And you know, the only people who are fit to be the captain of the ship are people who are effectively attuned to the highest truths of the Platonic forms, or the form of the good, particularly. And Al-Farabi sort of articulates on this from a more Islamic perspective. And I'm just going to read a little quote, actually, from his political regime, as it's translated, which sounds a bit severe. I wouldn't call it a regime, but he says, "Man can reach happiness only when the active intellect first gives the first intelligibles, which constitute the primary knowledge," so very akin to Platonic forms. He says, "However, not every man is equipped by natural disposition to receive the first intelligibles, because individual human beings are made by nature with unequal powers and different preparations." So effectively, like Plato, Al-Farabi's political philosophy entails translating the higher principles of the active intellect, which is basically an extra mental, trans-empirical realm of knowledge, very similar to the Platonic forms, translating those principles to the masses, and that's through religion, through storytelling, and through images. Now, I think there'd be, firstly, fascinating opportunity for dialogue between Al-Farabi and Roger Scruton, because although Scruton was not an overt Platonist, he certainly had a similar notion of needing to cultivate truth, beauty, and goodness in society by way of elevating people's consciousness towards higher principles rather than purely worldly ones. And although definitely towards the end of Scruton's career, he was indeed very, very sympathetic to Islam. Not many people know this actually, but he was. I think he really did see that was a common goal there. So I would love to see that dialogue between him and Al-Farabi. And then it would be really interesting to bring Foucault in there, because I think it would be fascinating to see how Foucault, who is quite monomaniacal about power, it'd be interesting to see how he would grapple with power as Al-Farabi and Roger Scruton conceive it, because for them it's a very qualitative thing. It's based on something much more noetic. It's about knowledge of something which is beyond human cognition. Essentially, that's the concept of the Platonic forms or the active intellect. Whereas generally Foucault only really analyzes power on a purely human level. And I'm aware that Foucault was actually quite sympathetic to the Iranian Revolution, which is, I need to dig deeper into that because it's a very, very curious, quite surprising. So I wonder if he might be more sympathetic to these types of societies, which, don't get me wrong, do have hierarchy. There is a sense that some people have higher knowledge than others and the need for a philosopher king and all of that. But that's very different to the kind of power that Foucault is so keen to deconstruct. It's not the same thing as an oligarchy, for example. It's not the same as a power which is based on corruption. So anyway, as a long answer to that question, but I think the dynamics would be fascinating. And also, you know, another major contrast is that both Al-Farabi and Scruton, they believe in positive values. They believe that truth, beauty, and goodness are objectively real things. Whereas with Foucault, it's always a negative. It's always deconstructing what's always there. There isn't really the same emphasis on postulating positive values which do exist. And this is actually one of the reasons why Scruton was critical of people like Foucault. And he criticized the left in the sense that, you know, as he says, on the left, it is the negative that inspires. Whereas for himself and also for Al-Farabi, it's about these positive forms and positive values.
Super interesting comment in relation to the negative and the positive. And I think in a certain sense, it really defines what the, I don't want to like pigeonhole complete political movements into two camps like that. But to a certain degree, it does define what the almost untranslatable difference between the perspectives of the left and the right are. Right. And I guess maybe a huge question in relation to that is, do you think, you know, if you put, just to take the two clear examples there, Foucault and Scruton, into a room with this, like two very clear examples of understanding from the negative and understanding from the positive, do you think that they can ever really sympathize with one another's position?
No, and I think the reason for that is because Scruton, although his religious undertones are often very subtle, and I don't think, to be honest, I think he could have articulated them better, but nonetheless, he had a very strong sense of there being such thing as the sacred. Whereas Foucault, like, again, don't want to generalize, but like most thinkers on the new left, they are materialists and they pride themselves on that. I mean, Marxist historical materialism, a lot of people believe that to be a seriously legitimate and strong ground on which to understand history. And I think that's the fundamental difference between the left and the right, or at least when I say the right, I mean the Scrutonian and even Farabian. People probably would feel quite hesitant to class Farabi as a right-wing thinker. I don't really want to go into that territory, but they certainly have that sense of the sacred and the need need to align worldly societies with those sacred values. And Scruton himself defined what he called metaphysical conservatism as being about trying to protect things from being profaned, preserving what is sacred. I think that's his wording. Whereas people like Foucault, I think Foucault was a little bit more critical of Marx's style of historical materialism, but nonetheless still a materialist. I mean, he denied the existence of truth and beauty overtly on several occasions. Being a materialist, they're just not concerned with these values. And I think that's the real difference. And as an aside, that difference isn't really reflected in modern politics, because nowadays the conservatives in their institutional form don't really believe in those sacred principles either, or rather maybe they do, but only on a very residual level. They just like, you know, they like how they buttress their identity of, you know, kind of Christendom and European values, which are usually quite vague anyway. So that's, I think, the fundamental difference. Yeah.
I'm not really sure that with the conservatives that the Christian values are there anymore. It seems to be almost like a loose Reaganite appeal to pulling up your bootstraps and capitalism and like some form of stability in that. But beneath everything, they're just the same sort of moral relativism as everyone else. And but I mean, it's just an immediate problem in terms of, you know, basically ever being able to understand each other, because arguably both sides are coming at it from that position of like, well, we take this for granted. Right. So it's like one side is we take nothing for granted. The other side is like there is these definite truths we begin from. So it's basically an immediate problem. But it's an interesting idea in relation to the left and the right, is that, you know, like you say, like defining people as right wing. It's like, well, maybe that definition just comes from the fact that they almost have the courage to say, yeah, well, this is what beauty is. This is what truth is. And then move from that. But.
Exactly. And I don't think that that's really represented now in mainstream conservatism. I don't think that's particularly groundbreaking. I think Scruton was the last of his kind. And you know, and there are lots of people who sort of claim to have succeeded Scruton, or I'm not going to, you know, give any names. I'm not out to just, you know, kind of ruthlessly criticize, but there are certain people who often regarded as, you know, succeeding that tradition, but they're not really. I think they very much have given up on the sacred. And I think until we resolve that issue, until one side picks that up again, I don't think that there is really much of a significant difference between the left and the right.
Well, maybe those thinkers will come back in. But moving into like the questions that I've devised basically from everything that you've written, which was on your own site, and your most recent piece in relation to sort of postmodernism and religion, and this is sort of probably the topic that we'll generally gravitate around. There's sort of this immediate problem in relation to basically having religion within a society or a world whose fundamental value or virtue is individualism, right? So in the Enlightenment, which you write about a lot, has loosely brought in this cult of individualism. But in what sense do you see that as affecting our understanding of what it is to be religious?
Yeah, that's a good question. And you'd be surprised how strong the Enlightenment currents still are, even on TikTok and in discourses surrounding spirituality, you know, in places which are usually quite sort of, you know, postmodern and you'd think would go against the grain when it comes to these doctrines of individualism. But anyway, I'll come to that later. So with the Enlightenment being the root of individualism, I mean, it's a very long process. I have been accused of making too many sweeping generalizations about the Enlightenment, and I think that's a fair criticism. I think you have to go back a bit to the Protestant Reformation, really, because that sowed those first seeds of doubt towards the authority of the church. And you could even say it sowed the first seeds of that incredulity towards meta-narratives that is the sort of textbook definition of postmodernism. But of course, that really came into full fruition during the Enlightenment, which was, you know, committed to justifying and rationalizing, this is the key word, why those institutions were suspect and why individual reason should triumph. And that was crystallized really through Kant, I think, and his definition of what enlightenment is. You know, he answers the question of what is enlightenment, and he says it's freedom from self-incurred immaturity, or I think it's translated in different ways, but you get the picture. And then that cross-pollinating with Descartes and the skepticism towards what lies beyond the individual subject, all of that in the same milieu essentially produces an epistemic individualism, which is only the individual can really know through individual reason. Now this became incarnated almost into psychoanalysis. Psychoanalysis, pronounce that in a strange way. In the sense that psychoanalysis was about locating that spirituality within. It had that epistemic certainty within the self, which I think can even be traced to Kant. And through that, you get the New Age movement, which tends to have a lot of psychoanalytic themes running through it. And then you get to the point where, kind of in the 90s, 2000s, spirituality just completely collapses into this individualistic this individualistic pursuit, really. And there's a great quote by Thomas Luckman, and he was writing this in the early 90s, and he said, the span of transcendence is shrinking. You know, it's contracting into the self. And similarly, even earlier than that, in fact, Christopher Lash, in his book Narcissism, which is just a fantastic book. I think going back to that sort of left-right divide, I think it's one of those things which both people on the left and the right can really appreciate, actually. And he says, you know, in a narcissistic society, the self is the highest form of spiritual liberation. So you can trace quite a clear genealogy, I think, from the Reformation and the Enlightenment, mediated through psychoanalysis and then into the New Age movement, and then go on to more recent manifestations, as it were, of that. You can really trace that genealogy there of individualism. And I think, going into his more recent examples, may as well talk about that now, is on TikTok, on Witch Talk. So Witch Talk, for those who don't know, I wouldn't even call it a community, because it's not really bound together in a way that even a New Age community would have been bound together in the 2000s. It's completely melted away any last residues of institutional religion. It's the most free-flowing thing. I mean, it's really just a hashtag, Witch Talk. Mm-hmm. But I was researching this Witch Talk movement hashtag online when I was doing my dissertation, and I found a really striking presence of these Enlightenment attitudes against organized religion in favor of individual religion. Mm-hmm. For example, there would often be more quite kind of tongue-in-cheek posts. There was, for example, a dialogue with a pagan, or a self-made pagan, pretending she was in a dialogue with a stereotypical Christian, and she was accusing the Christian of not free thinking. Which is really telling, because I just could hear Kant. I was like, oh wow, this person is trying to free themselves from their self-incurred immaturity. Okay, you know, it's very strongly there. And there's sometimes even more overt. You know, there's this woman. I think her name's Lilith something, and she's a pagan atheist.
Right.
Yes, and she will often make these quite polemical posts against Christianity, because, you know, it doesn't allow individual thinking and individual freedom. So that's it. The span of transcendence has truly shrunk. It's the climactic summation of the Enlightenment individualistic epistemology. Only truth exists within the self, and beyond that is suspect.
I mean, I'm, to be honest with you, I'm stuck on your pagan atheist comment. I think I'm going to be stuck there for some time. It just, more and more, it just seems that the modern world is basically just constantly people who wish to have their cake and eat it too, right? It's the attempt to have the, somehow retain and have the meaning of a higher spiritual good, and these like fundamental structural truths, if you wanted to speak in the language of the French continentals, who, you know, seem to be like the hegemonic patriarchs of our academic life at the moment, right? They're the ones who keep coming back, but if they want these sort of fundamental truth structures, but at the same time want to somehow have them within a postmodern fluxing individualism, where, so it's like, yeah, oh, I want to be pagan, but I also want to have the secular atheist thing, and there is just an immediate incompatibility, like you can't have both. And I mean it's a pretty basic question. I mean, what do you make of that idea of a pagan atheist?
Well, I think
surely this has kept you up at night.
No, it has. I mean, sometimes it's quite frustrating seeing these things and not being able to actually engage with it on a personal level and actually talk to these people. I think that's the thing. It's the classic being behind a screen. You can sort of build your own brand, and nobody can really touch it. And anyway, I think you're totally right that it is a contradiction in terms. I mean, I know a lot of pagans who would disagree with me and say, well, you know, you can be a pagan atheist, but perhaps when they say atheist, they just don't like the idea of theism that they've been taught. I think that's usually the most common one. Yeah. It's a real skepticism, incredulity towards the Abrahamic narrative, usually because they see that as being hegemonic, which is, it's not really true. I don't really think that, I mean, at a social level, that there's this myth, which even I was exposed to at university. There was often this myth when we were talking about things like privilege and power structures. Being a Christian was considered a privilege point. And I just don't think that's true. I mean, churches were being burnt down in Canada a few months ago, and the media didn't really say anything. They were, you know, defending the antagonists in that I mean, I won't digress into that, but yeah, to answer your question, I think you do. Okay, even if pagan atheist isn't necessarily a contradiction, I think some pagans could probably skirt around that and say, oh, it's, you know, we just don't believe in the Abrahamic God or whatever. But even if that's true, I think it's right that there is this picking and mixing of different ideologies, and even if they're not really theologically compatible, they sort of do it anyway. And I think in this sense, it is quite similar to the more traditional New Age movement, which sounds like an oxymoron, but really, You think the New Age is eclectic. I mean, this is just something else. At least the New Age still had institutionalized forms. Mm. You'd have texts that people were reading around similar times. Yeah. Yeah. You'd have groups, you know, yoga groups, transcendental meditation groups. You'd have gurus. There was still some residual, remaining kind of institutional aspect, basically. But now, you know, there's none of that. And as a result, it's completely eclectic. You can pick and choose whatever you like and create a sort of collage of ideologies, which is indeed a very postmodern act in itself. And I think Adam Posamai, who's written about the New Age movement, he's described it as being kleptomaniac. And I love that description because it's, you know, it's constantly stealing different elements. And so I think that sums up. I think that's why you see these seeming contradictions, because really there are no rules anymore. You can be anything. You can steal whatever you want from whatever culture, and which you'd think would be quite problematic. And I did actually see an article recently, which was Dear Witch Talkers, something like that, something quite patronizing. you know, here's how to decolonize your practice. And it was accusing witches of stealing elements of African witchcraft, or because it's, as I say, very syncretic in that you do run into some cultural, you know, cultural appropriation, if you'd like to use those terms, when you come to doing that. So
I mean, pretty much all occultism, modern mysticism is plagiarism. Right. And the more developed institutional forms are just have had their time to sort of create texts. Right. But if you go back through it, it all comes from somewhere else. So The idea of, I don't know, I'm always against that idea of like cultural appropriation, just because I don't. There's an oxymoron of trying to have cultural appropriation in a world where we are trying to both also support multiculturalism, diversity, and this fluxing idea that maybe not everyone can be defined as the stereotypical way they look or are. You can't have that and also say about colonialism, but I'm sure someone will call me up on that and I'll have to edit out this clip. Okay, there's a few comments on things you just said. One, in terms of that, the you know, this underlying idea, which I still agree is there and was there from when I was younger, that being a Christian was like a privileged position in the West, like as if in some sort of handmaid's tale fashion, Christians still had some sort of social privilege or superiority, right? And, you know, as John Michael Gray recently said to me, if you look at the words, the word privilege, privo latae is in private law, right? So as if Christians had some private law which they abided by that everyone else doesn't get to abide by. And it's like, well, okay, show me where this is. And, you know, it takes us back to, I mean, people who in this kind of debate, I think, are super important, and someone could write a really great book about how in the span of 10 years, the new atheist trend just sort of fried everyone's brains in terms of reality, right? I mean, I remember Christopher Hitchens and Sam Harris literally saying that the West is living in a theocracy, a Christian theocracy, and it's, oh, well, I mean, can I move to wherever you're living, Mr. Harris? Or you might be Dr. Harris, I apologize. I'm sure he's, you know, done a lot of good work. But it's just ridiculous because I don't really know where that is. And as for my other comment, I've sort of, that was it. So the other comment that I would say is that I think it's something we spoke about before when we briefly chatted was, so Jung had this idea that as we moved from the age of Pisces, I believe, to the age of Aquarius, one of the defining factors of this was the move from institutional religions to a personal relationship with the divine, which is sort of what we're talking about now. But I would actually bring into this a Gurdjieff quote, which I really enjoy and people misinterpret. I know you're smiling because I had to get Gurdjieff in. But he says, if you want to lose, people really misinterpret, and atheists actually love it. They're like, yeah, he's such a cool quote, man. It's so smart. But his quote is, if you want to lose your faith, make friends with a priest, right? And it's generally read like, oh, when you finally get into the nitty and gritty of this, you'll realize it's all false. But actually the emphasis is on the word friend, right? So if you want to lose your faith, make friends with a priest in that postmodern way of like, there's no authority. We're all friends. I can debate just as well as the priest. There's nothing higher than me. Like, no, you can't have that. Either you enter into the institution and the ideas sincerely and you say, right, okay, there is a, what some people might call like a master slave. You know, what, it's just the West's inability to basically be like, maybe there is something higher than me, right? But as soon as you enter into individualism and take that as your belief system, then nothing can be allowed to be higher than yourself.
Precisely. And that even, it goes back to what I was saying in the beginning about Al-Farabi's Islamic-tinged Platonism, basically. But you know, I'm definitely not the first to describe it as such. He's often called as the first Islamic Neoplatonist. I actually believe Al-Kindi was the first Islamic Neoplatonist. But anyway, that's another issue. That's for the Islamic studies crowd. But this is the thing with Al-Farabi. I mean, he's very set on the fact that, as he says in that quote that I read out earlier, not everybody is equal in terms of their intellectual receptivity. And so you need to have imams. That's the function of imams and the function of the virtuous ruler or the philosopher king of the city. It's not because those people are lesser in value necessarily. It's just that in terms of spiritual knowledge, in terms of being able to attain what Plato called noesis, which is the apprehension of the higher knowledge, the sort of looking at the sun from out of the cave, only a very few people can do that. And that's why you have these hierarchies in religion and also in society, ultimately. You know, not going to go into analyzing that. That has its problems. People like Karl Popper would certainly despise such an idea. You know, in the open society, he says, well, actually, you know, these Platonic views are actually quite fascistic and all these things. And, you know, I mean, that's the whole, I don't think that's the right term, because in these societies, it's not about control and domination. It's about inspiration. Especially with Al-Farabi, when you read his text, it's not, this is going to dominate people and we're going to control society. And he openly criticizes societies which do that, such as oligarchies, for example. He criticizes that because they're too controlling. They are too rigid. What's important for Al-Farabi is that these people like imams and highly educated, virtuous poets, storytellers, philosopher king, what's important is that they inspire the masses. And that's a positive thing. So yes, there is a power dynamic there. Of course there's a power dynamic, but it's a noetic one. It's not saying this person's more important, he's your master. It's saying it's just different gradations. And I'm only quoting Al-Farabi here. I don't wish to, you know, to talk about the practicalities of that. I think as a society, that kind of, you know, that kind of way of viewing things is just so difficult to comprehend now without it seeming, yeah, oppressive or whatever. Yeah.
I mean, nowadays, any discussion of power generally brings in the person who's sat in your room with screw on, probably sort of weeping. It's Foucault, right? And I've read a fair bit of Foucault, and I this is probably a really reductionist overview of of his philosophy of power, which seems to be the dominant philosophy of power at the moment. No one seems to have moved beyond that. But there seems to be that if you gravitate towards a philosophy of immanence and individuality, which inherently is immanent because everyone has to be on the same level in some sense, then any notion of power seems to basically, people believe that any notion of power and superiority is this, as if something is superior or higher or above, immediately or inherently means some form of domination. And I think to get out of that mindset that just because something is above you, it wishes to control you or dominate you or like ruin your life in some way or be fascistic, as you said, it isn't entirely true. And, you know, it's sort of like the irony of, you know, just to actually bring it to Islam, I was reading Islam Unveiled at the moment, and his discussion on you know, the translation of the word Islam and all these sort of Western atheists. And, you know, I'm thinking, of course, of Michel Houellebecq, who I should be doing a show on recently, take this word, like, the word literally means submission. And it's like, yeah, but from your materialist perspective, that it's, you're just so far from what that actually means for those who are in, who believe.
Yeah. Exactly. And to be fair to them, and to be fair of people who critique those power structures, I do understand why that comes from, because all we've ever really known in modern Western society is oligarchy and power structures which are genuinely bad. If you have a small number of people who rule everybody else based on, it's effectively avarice and greed and financial gain, that is a corrupt kind of power, because there's no virtue there. And Al-Farabi himself explicitly says this is the wrong kind of hierarchy. You can't have a hierarchy based on people who aren't actually spiritually attuned to the active intellect, he says, or the Platonic forms, if you want to go to a more traditionally Platonic way of viewing things. And so I do understand why people like Foucault criticize that. And I think when it comes to critiquing capitalism, I think it's fair enough. But the problem is that they can't distinguish between different types of hierarchy, because they're fundamentally materialist. Going back to what I was saying, they can't think maybe it's possible that somebody could be more sort of knowledgeable in a noetic sense. They just think, no, there is no noetic knowledge. That whole level of epistemology of higher truth, that's just no. Like, that's all just a fabrication. Mm-hmm. Same as the Marxists as well. Of course, that's the key tenet of historical materialism. And some people, you know, are really set in believing that. I find it very hard to be convinced by such a view when it's so clearly again an extension of Enlightenment rationality, materialism, anthropocentrism. And I will articulate more on this later. But I think that's where the biggest misunderstanding is. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So do you think these cool kids, these witch talkers, these rebels, radicals, do you think they're unknowingly developing their own power structures?
So I think firstly, there is definitely a conscious will to have power and control. And that is taking on a sort of quasi-metaphysical dimension now with casting hexes and spells. And I think given the, not to generalize, I don't know the precise demographic of these witch talkers, but I get the impression there are quite strong overlaps between, sort of quite progressive, kind of left-wing narratives. And so I think for them, they see their witchcraft as being about reclaiming a power that they feel has been taken from them. Mm-hmm. by other power structures, not magical ones, but political ones. Mm-hmm. And so it is objectively very fascinating that they're turning to magic as a way of revolting against that. But the irony is that as I was saying, in terms of the Enlightenment, continuity of Enlightenment thought, they still belong to the same power structure, really. Because their continuation of individualism and ultimately secularism and the complete skepticism towards any kind of authority and, I'm going to do what I want, this is my truth and my life and all that, and my brand or whatever, all of that is, it's not going against the grain. I mean, that is the norm now. So I think that they're not so much creating their own power structure, even though I think that is the intention. Rather, they are basically just tantamount to a software update, quite literally, on the current forms of current forms of life. And but I think the question of something I did want to talk about was about, can this kind of individualism ever be compatible with mysticism? That might be an interesting sort of thing to talk about.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, what are your thoughts? I thought we sort of touched on it, but I guess we went on a different digression. But so okay, but maybe before we, what do you consider that form of mysticism? How would you define that before we figure out whether or not it's compatible with individualism?
Do you mean the mysticism on TikTok, for example?
Is that the mysticism? Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think mysticism is a very difficult term. I'm sorry to be that person. It's like I studied religion for 3 years, and one thing that was constantly repeated was that religion is really hard to define. And then you have to sort of read all these papers about why religion is so difficult to define. And I mean, all of those were written by secular constructivists anyway. Yeah, that was sort of that always frustrates me. Anyway, but mysticism is genuinely really hard to define, because traditionally, not always, but particularly within the Islamic tradition, mysticism was something which came as a result of very sincere piety. Now, you know, there were some dissident Sufis, such as the Bektashis, who would drink wine and take part in Christian rituals and all these things. And of course, there's always going to be groups like that. But in terms of the most renowned Sufis, such as Ibn Arabi and also Rumi, actually, were very, very orthodox. The reason that they were able to attain such closeness to God was through a very perfected, rigorous praxis. And without that, they would often, you know, they would often even say themselves, you know, you will end up sort of lost in a sea of wonder, as Al-Ghazali put it. And Al-Ghazali is another one of these individuals who's a, you know, generally very respected classical Sufi in the sense that he was fully orthodox. Whereas I think particularly as you move into the 60s, Miller of sort of post-psychoanalytic Jungian mysticism, it kind of becomes completely detached from piety. And it's more about, you know, cultivating a relationship with God without religion. So it's actually a real contradiction of what mysticism, and I'm talking about the Islamic tradition specifically here. I can't give a definition in terms of Christianity, but I'm pretty sure it was very similar. And so there's been this real shift. So sorry, I can't really succinctly define it because people will often use it interchangeably, I find.
Okay. Maybe the definition will come about in terms of the discussion of whether or not you think it's actually compatible with our model. You know, I guess what you've sort of described as the default modern value, because it does seem like you're saying, I don't know. Okay, maybe I shouldn't say this, but it does seem like you're saying you're in agreement with the idea in a religious context that the actual conservatives. Are like the new radicals. That's the punk rock thing, right? Because you're saying that witch talk really is an aesthetic identity extension of neoliberalism.
Yeah, I think one can quite comfortably say that. I don't think that's particularly controversial. Because a lot of them are very pro science, pro rationality. Mm-hmm. They're quite conscious of their adherence to these enlightenment narratives because we all think that those represent progress.
Okay, so in relation to this problem of compatibility, which we've touched on a few times, you have an article on individualism and astrology, and you mentioned that astrology has been transformed into an individualistic exercise, which is sort of always in relation to altering one's self as opposed to something higher. And I guess before I sort of ask you the question, which is really whether or not in doing that, such praxis sort of completely loses its purpose. One really clear example of this is in the difference between, we sort of need a name for it, but I know a lot of people are calling it like Hellenistic astrology or traditional astrology, and the difference between that and modern astrology, which a lot of people now are like, astrology is so dumb. Like all it says is these vague Barnum statements, like you're going to have a creative week, or something along these lines, right? But in my discussions once again with John Michael Greer, he makes it clear that it was this sort of changed at the end of the Victorian era. But if you look at the modern, the traditional examples of astrology of that era, it wasn't nice. Like you go to an astrologer, you find out stuff, and it was like, yeah, I don't want to. Like it would be very specific, and it would say things like, yeah, by the way, next year it's going to be fairly awful, and you're probably going to be in a lot of pain. And there was a huge shift, I think, in that era, which isn't surprising at all, to the more modern forms of astrology, which were constantly basically targeted towards the self. And there wasn't really anything which wasn't to do with pleasure or happiness. And even if it was bad, it would always be wrapped up like bad things will come, but they'll lead to better things or some absolute nonsense, right? Yeah. So basically my question is whether or not this, on a practical level, this alteration of mysticism, religion, towards the self, basically nullifies the praxis.
Yeah, so I think astrology is very much a microcosm of this. And I think it's a good example because, as you say, it's something which has been so radically shrunk. Again, it's going back to what Luckman says about the span of transcendence shrinking. It's gone from being a way of understanding a human being's very small role in an interconnected cosmos to gratifying the human being for and of itself. And I'm really interested in the theology of astrology in the medieval Islamic context. And I did a video collaboration with Esoterica on this, which was really quite sort of theological, talking about people like Al-Kindi, the first Islamic philosopher, and how he viewed astrology. And okay, didn't use the word astrology, and certainly had no resemblance to what we're talking about now, but. For thinkers such as Al-Kindi, and you also find this in Jewish mysticism as well, in like the Zohar, for example, mm-hmm. There's a sense that the stars and planets are what Al-Kindi calls proximate agents for the acts of God. So the way that God influences the universe and ultimately what happens on earth and what happens to people and human relations and societies is mediated through the stars and planets and also meteorology, because he sees these things as being, he also adopts quite a Neoplatonic view, basically, where you have the celestial intelligences sort of in the middle mediating everything. And anyway, but the point of this is basically that astrology was only ever a means or a mechanism of understanding God's actions in a much more macro, you know, broader context. Whereas now, of course, it's become completely zoomed in and it's all about, oh, my Venus placement means this, and oh, my Mars is in Cancer. So, oh, my Mars is in Cancer, actually. I'm not sure, I can't remember what that says about me, something about my attachment style. Anyway, I shall not give into that. Mm. That type of astrology. I mean, it was always quite fun. I can understand why people enjoy it.
There's another example of that, again, that the early forms of that astrology. I remember someone showed me, like, for instance, to give a very strange example, Aleister Crowley's natal chart, right? And basically, like, nowadays, these natal charts would be like, they're always like, whatever the truths is that have been handed down to us, probably from people who were very serious and were like, this is the reality of it, of your birth situation. They now would be all happy and good, and whatever happens, like, you have a great life. But like, if you look at Crowley's chart in terms of traditional astrology, he should have just been an absolute lame middle manager, right? He really should have just been. So you have to give it to the man, because he was one of the few that somehow broke out of it. But like, if you actually read the natal charts in this traditional style, a lot of people's lives are like, yeah, by the way, you're just going to have a really boring life, and it's going to kind of, and like, maybe it'd be like, yeah, you're going to die young. So I feel like the thing with that is the, like, contemporary utilitarian aspects are removed because you have the higher thing. So it's like, it doesn't really matter. And I know this is completely contrary to everything we know in the modern world, but it's like, it doesn't matter if you're going to die young, because it's in relation to a greater divine purpose. Whereas, of course, in relation to the individual without God, well, that's the worst thing that can ever happen, because you're your own God. So,
yeah. No, that's such a good point. And that's the reason why so many debates about astrology, particularly in the Abrahamic traditions, were very bound up with conversations of predetermination. Mm. But yeah, just to hone in on the question of, you know, is individualism potentially ever compatible with mysticism? Mm. I think this is a question that poses some quite deep theological considerations. And I'd quite like to talk a bit more about Islamic mysticism and how that squares this notion of kind of individualism and mysticism. I mean, I don't mean individualism in the modern sense, and I'll explain why it's completely different. But so, a really interesting account of the relationship between the individual and God and prayer, and ultimately the pursuit of knowing God and establishing a relationship with God. A really interesting source for that is Ibn Arabi, and also Henri Corbin, who has written a lot on Ibn Arabi's mysticism. I do, just as a disclaimer, I do have some qualms with Henri Corbin, just because I think he was a classical Orientalist, and I think some of his views on sort of Shiism and Sunniism and kind of Sufism as being this mystical Christianized other, I am skeptical of that. But having read Ibn Arabi, I do think that his work does do justice to Ibn Arabi. I think I'm fairly comfortable with going on his commentary. So anyway, so something that Henri Corbin talks about with reference to Ibn Arabi is this concept of the manifestation of God being particularized to the individual who is engaging with God. So there's this concept of tajalli, which means manifestation. And Henri Corbin will also sometimes use the term theophany. And what both of those mean, that tajalli, manifestation, theophany, is it's the appearance of God to each individual. And what's really, really consistent in these articulations of the relativization almost of God to the individual is that the way that God appears will be determined by the perception of the individual. For example, in Sufism, a really common motif that you find in lots of Islamic mystical literature is that of the mirror. And it's the idea that human beings, our souls are like mirrors. And mm-hmm. when we engage in prayer, when we engage in faith of any shape or form, really, we're trying to reflect the light of God. Mm-hmm. And the degree which we reflect the light of God is dependent on the status of our mirror and what condition the mirror is in. So if you're somebody who is very indulgent and who gives in to the ego, your mirror will be sort of tarnished and foggy. And so it won't reflect the light of God in a clear, lucid way. Whereas if you've strived for spiritual purification, I think that's the concept of a tazkiya in Sufism, you've essentially polished the mirror. And that's a really beautiful simile, metaphor rather, that you find in lots of Sufi poetry and also in Henri Corbin and Ibn Arabi to some extent, although it's a bit more, Ibn Arabi does use that metaphor, I believe. Don't quote me on that. But anyway, so again, there's this distinction between there is the light of God itself and there's the way in which that light appears, which is ultimately subject to the human constitution. And even going back to Al-Farabi as well, he acknowledges this, phrases it in a slightly different way, but recognizes, you know, everybody is different. People have different modes of receptivity. And this goes into a much more... A kind of broader hermeneutic of the Quran, in which there is a distinction between God in its absolute, his absolute ineffable form, and then God as he appears to the individual. And this is actually reflected in the language used to describe God in the Quran. So there are two words for God which reoccur in the Quran. So the first is Allah, and the second is Rab. And often Allah will be used to describe God as being the ineffable transcendent. And then Rab is usually prefixed to the pronoun e, which is like my. So Rabi means my Lord. So there's this notion that there's sort of two expressions of God. There's God as it's completely inevitable, the absolute unity of Tawheed, which is completely, the human senses simply cannot grasp that. And then there's this slightly more anthropomorphized, personalized notion of Rab or Rabi, my Lord. And again, you've got this is, you know, quite systematized within the Islamic tradition. For example, two of the 99 names of God, you've got Tanzih and Tazbih. And Tanzih means transcendence, that ineffable, and Tazbih is the more anthropomorphic and personal. So you see what I mean? There's a distinction. And in the Akbarian mysticism of Ibn Arabi and Henri Corbin as well, and to some extent Al-Farabi, Suhrawardi, I mean, many of these mystical thinkers, they were able to distinguish between the absolute ineffable Allah and then the personal God, the Rab, as it appears to each person. So my point in raising this is that there is an acknowledgement of some, not individualism as we know it today, but of the need for particularization for each individual to engage with God and the sacred. I think what's really important when you're looking at that and comparing it to what we see today, these very hyper-individualized forms of spirituality, is that in these mystical schemas, although they acknowledge that each human being receives God in their own way, it's still ultimately one God mm-hmm. and it's one truth. And the human being receptivity up to that is partial and relativized. So it's still part of one absolute truth. Mm-hmm. Whereas in modern forms of what we're seeing on TikTok and even, you know, New Age spirituality, most modern forms of spirituality, which as we've discussed, are obviously very individualistic, they don't see it that way. Rather, they see their apprehension of the sacred as being truth in and of itself. They generally don't see it as being a small, relativized imprint of a more universal truth, but rather they see that truth as being self-contained and they build their own truth. Do you see the really fundamental distinction there?
Yeah.
And again, that's why I feel quite comfortable in describing these spiritualities as being postmodern, because going back to Foucault, it's this idea that any notion of objective truth is suspect, and therefore, you know, we kind of have to create our own truths in a way, just for a sort of in a personal personal capacity. So they are very postmodern. And again, this is why I fundamentally believe that Islam and postmodernism can never will never be able to reconcile with each other. I mean, that's a whole other conversation. There's some great reading material on this elsewhere. But so that's the difference, I think.
Okay. Do you think? I mean, this is something you've commented on a lot. You had that great tweet where you basically were stating that from a postmodern perspective, all this, the study of religions, the study of mysticism, especially the study of practices and religious experiences, they're basically taken as anthropological social artifacts. They're never taken sincerely. They're not taken as actual, like, that obviously didn't happen, but we have to like somehow deconstruct the thing and try work things out. And this is basically this same question again of is the acceptance of the perspective that you're within, which is the postmodern perspective, right? Of, well, as we've discussed, you accept that is true and then view everything else through it. And do you, I mean, I'm assuming that you see this form of study as just extremely harmful.
Yeah, I think so, because the postmodern subject, and I myself am a postmodern subject, there's really no denying, not out of choice, but just because I grew up in what was effectively a post-truth world, really. I mean, Christianity was there in a very residual form. The C of E school I went to, the worship was basically just a few harvest time hymns with a sort of four chords, pop song. So I think I was of a generation, and probably also you as well, where we were sort of born into that world where the claims to truth had already been corroded, basically. Mm-hmm. And so in that environment, you have no choice but to create your own truth. Obviously, I don't see it that way. I think that truths do objectively exist, but nonetheless, the way that you come to it will be from quite a postmodern perspective, because things are all on equal footing, especially because of the internet and detraditionalization. And those two things are quite co-constitutive, because being exposed to different ideologies, different cultures, different types of people on the internet, it really does destabilize what the norm is. And I think that's a huge reason why tradition really struggles to survive, because people are constantly exposed to ideas outside of the periphery of those traditions, which is, yeah, it's destabilizing, which is why it's ironic, but also quite admirable that you are finding traditionalist groups coming together through the internet, like, the traditional Catholic group, for example. There's, of course, an irony there in the fact that traditionalism is being sort of simulated through a detraditionalizing force such as the internet.
This also brings me and makes me think of a quote which was in one of your pieces, which is, you state, the default designation of enlightenment rationality constitutes a form of epistemological supremacy. And this is sort of going back to what I was saying about the postmodern mindset is our sort of the default, I guess, in a certain way, supremacy, right? We go from that and then we understand everything else from it. And that, in a certain sense, even though we don't have truths, our one truth is there is no truths. Right, so we always go from that perspective. But what do could you expand on what you sort of mean in terms of this epistemological supremacy as this default designation of enlightenment rationality, which is a very good academic sentence.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, I think it's probably worth just sort of recapping a bit what I was saying previously about how a lot of these modern movements which claim to be or appear to be revolting against the status quo actually retain the fundamental pillars of enlightenment rationality, particularly where it comes to religion. As I said, on TikTok, there's this suspicion towards religion, and in that sense, it's a clear continuation. And so in that sense, I would understand it as being a form of epistemological supremacy, because it's the notion that the enlightenment suspicion towards truth beyond the human subject, which is perhaps a bit of a generalization, because there were more nuanced thinkers who still did believe that there was an unseen, but rather just that we can't access it. That was, of course, one view which was circulating around the time of the Enlightenment. So it's not a monolith, but generally the legacy of the Enlightenment has been, rejecting those external truths in favor of the individual reason. And this is something which just bleeds into all kinds of academic discourses, for example, constructivism in religion, this idea that they're all sociocultural constructs, the idea that when analyzing religion, it's all just these things which have arisen out of materialist conditions, effectively. Mm-hmm. That in itself is a product of the Enlightenment thought. Is the denial that there could be some truth beyond humans that has a real impact on our lives. So you ask about my use of the term epistemological supremacy, which is quite a severe wording. And I'll often also use similar terms such as hegemony and even the concept of, you know, colonization. I see it as a form of epistemological colonization because it's effectively projecting a worldview which is rationalistic, naturalistic, and ultimately denying trans-empirical truths. Projecting that onto other cultures and measuring their progress based on the extent that they adhere to modern doctrines of science, or rather scientism, important distinction between science and scientism. And I think that is a form of supremacy and also colonization. And I use those terms, I suppose, really because I think it's important to sort of speak in the language of people who are concerned about decolonization and things like that, because it seems to be a huge blind spot in those discussions, because they're all about deconstructing European hegemonies when it comes to, for example, the nation state. I've read some, you know, very, very strong arguments against why, you know, for example, the nation state is an Enlightenment construct which shouldn't have been imposed on others. That's quite a common argument articulated wonderfully by Wa'il Halak in The Impossible State. So there's definitely lots of scholarly efforts to decolonize certain Enlightenment ideas and their impact on non-Western countries. But there is this huge blind spot, as I say, because when it comes to issues like religion and the unseen, which is a concept in Islam, the al-ghaib, the idea of unseen realms beyond the empiricism of the human sense organs. When it comes to the existence of those realms and other forms of knowledge, they are still very much laughed at, actually, mm-hmm. and completely ridiculed. And one of the most compelling articulations of this residual colonial almost hegemony of European Enlightenment epistemology and rationality is actually an economist called Rajani Kanth. And it's a real rare gem of a book which he wrote. I say rare gem because it's quite a spectacular volume, actually, but doesn't really seem to be cited anywhere. And it's one of those esoteric academic books, which I think is £100 or something to buy, but I managed to get access to my university library. And it's called Against Eurocentrism. And it's really tackling this Enlightenment supremacy, this epistemological supremacy. And I would like to read a short quote from that, which I think sums it up very well. So this is Rajani Kanth. He says, "The arrogance with which European science condemned alternative epistemologies to perdition in trying to secure for itself a sole monopoly of the means to social knowledge, while parasitically devouring the discoveries precisely of these other traditions." And he talks about, for example, pharmacology, Western pharmacology, as being quite a good example. So the West will reject any kind of legitimacy of Islam or the unseen realms, but it will take some of its developments in science and not credit them. Now, I think it's fair to say that since Rajani Kanth wrote this book in, I think, 2004, you are definitely seeing the rise of universities making a conscious effort to historically decolonize and to acknowledge, okay, this actually wasn't a Western invention. This came from the Islamic world, or this came from somewhere else. And that's a positive thing, just because it's historically inaccurate to claim otherwise, to claim that everything was the West or the Greeks. I mean, it's just basic fact checking. But the irony is that while these efforts to decolonize at a historical level are there, and there is some progress in that respect, they aren't really, when it comes to the epistemology of these other cultural systems, they are still very much rejecting them, and they're very, very skeptical towards the legitimacy of what those cultures actually believe. And this manifests in all sorts of ways. I mean, the secularization of Islam is one of them, something that I've been seeing a lot in that particular environment. Won't delve into that really, but it just seems like a very bizarre blind spot, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of the great paradox of Western academia at the moment is that you have these figures such as Derrida, Foucault, who we've spoken about a bit, to a certain extent Deleuze, perhaps Baudrillard, Lyotard, these great male figures who are sat at the top who you know, I just from my own personal perspective and those that I sort of know who are in graduate courses of philosophy are the sort of the patriarchs, ironically, of being studied, and they have this inbuilt anti-hegemonic form of their philosophy, and yet it's never self-questioning. Mm-hmm. They don't recognize their own postmodern hegemony in relation to sincerely treating other cultures with the respect which would be there if they took that culture sincerely, if you see what I mean.
Yes.
So
yes,
it's like basically like, yeah, we'll talk about your culture. We'll talk about, you know, we want to diversify. We want to beat colonialism, but we want to do it on our terms, which in itself, as far as I'm concerned, is a really genuinely important form of racism.
It's
covert hegemonic continental racism is
absolutely
going into it and being like, obviously we have the correct way of seeing things, but we really want to delve into your culture, but not on your culture's terms, which basically immediately means you're not dealing with the same thing.
No, precisely. I think it's quite a hard hitting point, and it's a huge blind spot. And I think it's true. They're upholding what is essentially a European, specifically European Enlightenment hegemony. I will say sometimes I do use the word Eurocentric, but I think that is slightly, I don't think that's quite accurate, because it's Enlightenment centrism. Because don't forget, Europe has a history that wasn't the Enlightenment. And I'm all for reviving that. I think there is this creation myth that a lot of contemporary conservative politicians, for example, have, which is that, you know, European history is about free speech and liberty and all these, which are really French Enlightenment imports. Mm-hmm. It's contentious as to whether that's true.
For most modern people, the meaning of life in terms of where we can find it in history begins in the 1800s.
Exactly.
I think you talked about
again,
that.
It's hegemonic. I think perhaps not even... Eurocentric is a bit inaccurate. Mm. Enlightenment-centric is good, but also chronocentric and presentist is another one. It's about advocating a supremacy of a particular period of time and that epoch. And just to add to this, I think you didn't actually mention, but Marx himself, maybe you did, Marx himself, I think, is the best example of this. Let's not forget that Marx's theory is entirely Enlightenment-centric and scientistic, and then comes directly from the European Enlightenment and projects those paradigms. Again, it's materialist, it's anthropocentric, it retains, Rajani Kant, for example, describes the Enlightenment anthropocentrism as anthropocentric vanity. And I would say that Marx, without a doubt, retains that. And it's because of this that I believe John Gray, the philosopher, In one article he wrote a few years ago, describes Marxism as being one of the finest flowers of the European Enlightenment, and which is a great sentence. It's absolutely true. Every single Enlightenment narrative of progress, of science, is comfortably accommodated within Marxism and unquestioned. And therefore, as you say, it's quite ironic that people will use the analytical rubric of Marxism to talk about injustice and hegemonies whilst upholding the hegemonies which still go unquestioned by all sides of the political spectrum, really.
I mean, maybe we'll try finish on an optimistic note, though I know you're very pessimistic, so this might not,
I do try not to
this
be.
Might not work. This might just end with a whimper. But do you... let me think. Because I don't want to talk about return, because I think we're both aware enough that return is, as Abdul-Hakim Murad said in my recent interview, is just bad politics and bad religion. Like, it's just silly. And sort of just basically a fantasy. But do you foresee a future in the sense of a new or at least reinvigorated re-understanding of religions, traditional values, and mysticism, especially in the West, where they're treated sincerely? Do you see that as being a possibility, at least, please?
So I think if we can continue to use the language of decolonization and of hegemonies, I think there is a real chance that people will start to listen, I think. I think if you describe things using those terms, not just to be tongue in cheek, but because that's truly what they are hegemonies, as we've just outlined. I think if you can expand the, if you can increase the amount of attention that's paid to that in academic studies, I think there could be a chance of people questioning those axioms. And I also think the internet, and I think I'll finish on the possibilities that the internet may pose, and I'll try and do so in an optimistic manner. So with the internet, I think this does pose some potential possibilities for revival of more, not returning to tradition, but reviving some aspects of traditional ways of thinking. Although, as I've said, the internet is fundamentally a detraditionalizing force, it is something which is antithetical to real notions of community and coherent systems of belief shared by people, because of course cyberspace is so amorphous and constant exposure to different ways of viewing the world. Although all of that is true, I think there are loopholes in a way wherein actually the freedom which is provided by those platforms could actually be conducive to people reaching out to each other and people actually having these conversations and perhaps even genuinely eventually going against the grain of the secular hegemonies, as we've discussed. I mean, as I touched on before, there are some really strong Catholic, for example, traditional Catholic communities which have been born on the internet. And don't get me wrong, I think a lot of those are superficial, but I say this firsthand, having met some of these people in person and being involved in their communities just at a social level. I think that something real is happening, and I think it will continue. I hope it will continue. In a way, the sort of seemingly limitless possibilities of the internet in a distinctly postmodern fashion, which I will acknowledge, do allow us to go beyond the truth of the predetermined truth of secular orthodoxy, and perhaps in a very ironic, slightly paradoxical way, actually use the internet to go beyond that secular orthodoxy. You won't hear me being this optimistic normally, but I think it's genuinely it's a possibility.
Using the modern world against itself. I feel like that's a good place to finish up. But whereabouts can we find your work?
So I have a website, which is esmelkpartridge.com, and I also use Twitter, and my handle is just esmelkpartridge.
Cool. Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you.